This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's where the door person who checked our IDs said, "Be careful in there. It's delicious."
Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And one of these days, I'm going to get used to the name of our show.
One of these days. As you may or may not know, we recently got back from a trip to Asheville, where we got the opportunity to talk to so many folks about the organically weird and intentionally wild food and drink scene there. One of Asheville's nicknames, as voted on in a poll by the Brewers Association and Examiner.com, is Beer City, USA. And in 2012, it made the Travel Channel's list of top seven cities to drink beer. So we knew we had to do an episode on Asheville beer.
Obviously. And this is that episode. And that door person who warned us about deliciousness was at Wicked Weed's Funkatorium, which is one of over three dozen breweries offering locally produced beers in a town of just 90,000 people.
That's a lot of good beer.
It is, and it's a lot of craft beer. Because with the loosening of blue laws and a deepening thirst from the public, craft beer has transitioned from niche to mainstream over the past, like, decade or so in the United States. And the definition of craft is a little bit sticky, and Wicked Weed is actually a great example of that, as we'll get into later. But basically, craft beer is what's made in small-ish batches by independent-ish brewers. It was a nearly non-existent category here in the States in the lean years between Prohibition, which, along with industrialization, forced most small brewers out of business, and the late 70s, which is when Congress legalized home brewing. There were only 45 independent breweries nationwide in 1978.
Only 45?
As of 2017, there were over 6,000.
Wow. And as of 2015, out of the $106 billion total in beer sales, craft beer accounted for $22.3 billion of that.
Ooh.
And as we touched on in our Overview of Asheville episode, breweries are a keystone of the community and in a way you don't necessarily see in other cities. They're family environments. In an article for Serious Eats called Why Asheville is the Best Beer City in the USA, Writer Katie Norofsky compared breweries to neighborhood cul-de-sacs and describes how in no other city would she feel as comfortable bringing her newborn to a brewery.
Actually reminds me of England, now that I think about it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because pubs there are family places. Like, you see kids there all the time.
Huh.
Yeah.
It's a bit different to the United States, but not Nashville.
No.
Something else we talked about in our overview episode was art and the appreciation of craftsmanship in Asheville, and that includes beer. One of the most famous Ashevillians, author Thomas Wolfe, often wrote about beer and was known to be very fond of it. In his fiction, in heavy quotes, book about a city called Altamont, which was Asheville, beer played a pretty large role. And for the 7 years after its 1929 release, the book was banned in Asheville because the people Wolfe fictionalized were none too happy with his descriptions of them.
Ah.
And this was much to the annoyance of F. Scott Fitzgerald, who went around yelling at the city council and librarians about it not being on the shelves. Fitzgerald came to Asheville while his wife, Zelda, was being treated at a sanitarium on and off again. And he was, at the time, quote, on the wagon. But for him, that meant no hard liquor, but as much beer as he could drink, which turns out, on average, was 30 bottles a day.
Oh, my goodness, my gracious.
Yes.
He must have gotten up very early in the morning.
He was staying at Grove Park Inn. And they, in conjunction with Highland Brewing, who we're going to talk about later, have tried to recreate possibly the beer that he was drinking. It's called Great Gatsby IPA or something.
Oh, that's fascinating, though.
Yeah. His secretary said, never had she seen so much beer bottle trash made by one person. To help us sort this whole beer scene out, we talked to the person who literally wrote the book on it, beer historian and consultant Ann Fitton Glenn. In 2012, she published Asheville Beer, An Intoxicating History of Mountain Brewing. She's got a second book about beer on the way, so she seemed like a pretty excellent person to talk to.
Oh, and she was an excellent person to talk to. We met up with Ann Fitton at Asheville Brewing in the downtown area early in the morning when suppliers were loading in for the day. So if you hear any clangs, that's just one that slipped through.
You know, people want to buy from their neighbors and they want to support local, but there are not enough people here. I mean, there are maybe 90,000 people in the city of Asheville, maybe 140,000 people in Buncombe County. So it's not enough to support as many breweries as there are here now. So I think the Chamber of Commerce told me that the last survey they did a few years ago, 14% of the, I think it's like 9 million people who visit Asheville yearly, and you might need to check that, but it's close to that most recently, 14% of them visited at least one brewery and said that that was a factor in why they came here.
We did check that, and it was actually 10.7 million tourists per year as of 2016, 14% of which is 1.5 million drinking buddies. So you start to see how that sheer number of breweries is supported.
And for a weekend, we were some of those drinking buddies.
Oh, yeah.
We sampled beer at Highland, Catawba, Twin Leaf, Burial, Bramari, Highwire, Wicked Wheat, and I think more.
Probably.
Yeah. We had a lot of beer is what we're saying.
Yes.
We enjoyed all of the beautiful beer puns.
I am Brut, hop champagne.
Yeah.
Christopher Walken, O-A-X-A-C-A-N.
It's so good.
It was a chocolate nitro stout, and those were just at Highland.
Yeah, they were everywhere. And we enjoyed the beer, too, of course. So many interesting things on tap, too. Experimental things. A PB&J beer. A beer inspired by an Aperol Spritz. Everyone has fun with it, but people take their beer very seriously there.
Mm-hmm.
We encountered this while trying to decide on what to drink at Wicked Weed's Brew Pub, which we talked about in studio with super producer Dylan when we got back. Dylan and I were going to get a flight of beer. And this young man was not going to allow it to happen.
He was not. There was a bartender who was very adverse to the idea.
Mm-hmm. He went into a whole thing about it's the worst way to enjoy beer. It ruins the smell. Don't you even know about the smell? And then why would you even taste beer that way? I'll let you try any beer you want, and then you can get a whole one, and you'll have a much better experience. He went on for like 4 to 5 minutes. And Dylan and I were already like, okay, but he kept going.
He was like, I'll give you as many free samples as you want. You can try anything that you want to, but getting a flight of beer is like trying to throw a coin in a wishing well that is 500 feet away and it's shrinking.
Yeah.
And I don't understand what that means, but I'll never forget it.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Simon Pegg in Star Trek when he's like talking about his warp theory. Anyway, it was very eloquently put and it was a scene to behold. Like, he was excellent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he was very good at recommending things.
Yeah.
He also, in a fit of comedic pique, drop kicked a bar towel and somehow landed it on top of a bottle like 8 feet off the ground. I think he's a wizard is what I'm saying. Okay, all right, but let's back up. This volume of brewing is fairly new in Western North Carolina, but according to Ann Fitton, brewing and distilling is in Asheville's DNA.
So this is somewhat apocryphal, but I found documentation about it. So Asheville was not started until the late 1700s because this was a very isolated mountainous area and it was hard to get to. But the government in Raleigh decided to establish a city seat for Western North Carolina in the late 1700s. And they sent some city commissioners out to the area, and they were looking actually about 3 miles south of here, kind of where Biltmore is now, because there was this kind of flat, open valley surrounded by mountains. But then apparently, this tavern owner, who had a little tavern at the crossroads of the Drovers Road, invited the commissioners up to taste his Mountain Dew. And the story goes that the commissioners came up here, which is about where the Asheville Courthouse is now, and went to this tavern and just had a rip-roaring good time and said it was some of the best locally made whiskey they'd ever had, and that actually the seat of the town should be a little further north because where there's good whiskey, there is going to be a good community. So you can kind of say that this town was founded on local alcohol production.
True or not, beer has been part of Asheville's makeup since early days. Beer recipes from the area out of the 1800s show that most families have their own beer recipe. Making your own hooch, the history of moonshine in the area is easier to trace, but it does closely parallel and intersect with beer, was a way of life. Beer was something you made on your own, and at the time it was low alcohol, maybe like 2 to 3%. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the family would drink it, kids included, because it was perceived to be cleaner than water. This may or may not have been true in North Carolina.
Funnily enough, lots of people we talked to cited the quality of the water from the French Broad River as a reason for having so many breweries in Asheville.
Yes, but it was almost certainly true in Europe. So a lot of folks in Asheville were European immigrants, and this attitude toward beer came with them. Asheville was a waypoint town, somewhere you'd stop in between places. After a railway was put into the town in the 1800s, Asheville saw fairly rapid population growth. By the 1900s, Asheville had 18 saloons, mostly located on what they called Hell's Half Acre. All of that came to an end in 1906 after a drunkard went on a murderous rampage that left several people, including two police officers, dead.
Oh, wow.
This prompted Asheville to become the first southeastern city to vote for prohibition, and it stuck around in one way or another for 4 decades. Hell's Half Acre, for the most part, was shut down, going on to house appliance stores, and only now is it being revitalized. Even at Prohibition's end, beer brewers faced other blue laws that made their lives difficult, and some still do to this day. Here's Ann Fitton.
Even after Prohibition was overturned by the 21st Amendment, there was still what's called local option, which means every town, city, municipality, county got to vote whether or not they would allow alcohol. And so for a long time, North Carolina as a whole only allowed like 3.2% beer, what they called near beer at that time. And then very slowly, the laws have changed, but every single time laws change, there's a vote.
Compared to a lot of other cities, Asheville entered the craft brewing scene quite a bit later, in 1994, when one Oscar Wong moved there from Charlotte to open Highland Brewing Company.
Oscar is really very much the one that kicks off craft brewing in North Carolina. One of the key folks kicks it off on the East Coast. He said he used to have a hard time even getting bottles. Like the first time he called to get a bottle order, you know, he needed so many thousand bottles, and they didn't even know what to do. I mean, they were used to, you know, Anheuser-Busch calling and we need a million bottles or something like that. So early on, and the great thing too, that, and I don't know if he wouldn't talk about it himself, but Oscar grew the industry by being cooperative. He always built an air of cooperation between brewers. He was never threatened as other brewers opened, but just pulled them in and grew the industry as well as his business. Brewing's really cooperative. I mean, nationally it is, and I think part of that is very much seen in Asheville. I mean, you go to any place and they've done cooperative beer making with somebody down the street. I mean, they're competitors, but nobody views it that way.
That's area native Kevin Frazier, a history professor at Western Carolina University. If you listened to our previous episode introducing some of the history of the city, you'll remember how in the late 90s and early 2000s, Asheville started, well, pulling itself out of the ashes of a long economic depression through the food and drink scenes. Here's Ann Fitton again.
For a long time, there were only three or four breweries. The first one was Highland. And then there was Green Man, and then Asheville Brewing, and then French Broad Brewery. And it really was only until kind of the early 2000s that a few more came along. But then mostly it's been the past 5 or 6 years that the craft beer movement has really taken a hold here, as well as across the country.
Why beer? Like, what do you think has captured not only the world, but also Asheville specifically?
It's inexpensive.
There you go.
Yes. I mean, it's certainly more affordable than a lot of other alcoholic beverages, even if it's locally made with fancy ingredients like guava or, you know, sour yeast or whatever. You know, it's relatively inexpensive and usually lower in alcohol. You can drink more of it. You know, historically, everyone drank beer all the time because of it's got just enough alcohol to kill bacteria, but not enough to make you really drunk. Right. So if you go back in history, there's stories about, you know, people making their own beer on the farms around here, and everybody got beer with lunch, and everybody got, are you bringing us nachos?
Oh, holy heck.
Teaching them some new stuff.
Well, I just heard that there was a nacho summit going on over there.
Never too
a beer interview interrupted by a nacho summit.
Quick nacho summit aside, the way that we were seated, I couldn't see the nachos coming, but Annie and Dylan could, and I've never witnessed anyone react to a plate of nachos with such abject terror. We were so full from breakfast, and at which I had been full from dinner. It was a lot of nachos.
It was indeed. But we powered ahead, as professionals do.
Another thing I really love about American beer is, you know, there are four main ingredients in beer. There's water, malted grains, hops, yeast, the magic, love yeast. Y'all like yeast too?
Yes,
so much. It's so cool. It's so cool. Yes. But, you know, with those four ingredients, plus we call adjuncts, which can be anything from spices to herbs to fruits to coffee to chocolate. I mean, there's so many different styles of beer you can make. I mean, you can walk around this town to, you know, if you could go to 20 breweries in one day and you could taste 10 beers at every brewery and every single beer would be different. It's remarkable. None of them taste the same because of the mix of those ingredients and how creative you can be with it. And American brewers, particularly American craft brewers, have really taken that art form to another level.
Those four main ingredients, all of them can be found in or around Asheville. Good, clean water from the French Broad River, hops from Echo View Farm or Hoppin' Blueberry, malt from Riverbend Malt House. As Ann Fitton put it in her book, from farmer to maltster to brewer to beer drinker, all within a few hundred miles. It's a locavore's dream. But not everyone was happy at the idea of breweries in Asheville. And we'll get into that after a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach!
Give me great food.
Tacos!
Give me adventure.
Hiking!
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise!
Give me some smiles.
Cheese!
Give me more beaches.
Beaches!
What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
...tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. ...that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. So we need to talk about Highland Brewing, not just because it's one of the places that we got to go, but because, as we mentioned, prior to the mid-90s, there wasn't really a beer scene in Asheville.
Along comes a retired engineer by the name of Oscar Wong in 1994, the same year Jurassic Park came out. Every time I see 1994, that's the first thing I think of. I don't know why. And he had an idea. What started as beer experiments in a basement led to the first legal brewery post-prohibition in Asheville and helped pave the way for all the other breweries. As strange as it may seem, knowing what we know now, a lot of the locals were not on board in the beginning.
Because we were the first ones in town, we did get some letters that were like, you're going to ruin this place. And Dad wanted to be clear to say, no, we're going to make this better. And we're going to give a reason for people to come together and talk, whether it's about beer or whatever. And the neighbors are going to come together. And so that has happened to a degree that he never would have envisioned.
That's Oscar's daughter, Leah Wong Ashburn. Though she's now the president and CEO and family owner of Highland Brewing, her path to that role was an indirect one.
He started selling beer in Charlotte, which was really exciting to me. And that's when I asked for a job. And that is when he turned me down for a job. So I found my own way, as he told me to do. And that worked out great. I mean, it was very wise for him not to hire me when I was 24 and I knew nothing. And he didn't need me. But it was fun to kind of get to know the staff a little bit through, the annual staff getaway. When we're for a whole weekend, we go to this funky fishing lodge and some people camp and we cook together and there's a fire the whole time and we bring the beer truck and there's a river and we have a great time. So I got to go to that. And it was wonderful to learn and about what the brewery was doing, not only in beer, but in community, over a period of time before Dad offered me a job. And then I turned him down. So that was pretty cool.
Ooh.
So, right, the plot thickens. So it was another 8 years, 16 years in total, between the time I asked for a job, he offered me one, that I finally accepted in 2011.
Going back to the new stuff that you guys are working on around here, how do you conceive of new beers? Like, how do you beer?
Never been asked that. I love that. So one of my favorite things about the way that Highland works that's unusual is that we've got multiple brains in the creative space of creating new beers. So, and I will take multiple brains in a creative process over one. It just like feels natural. Everybody kind of nods when I say that, like, of course that's a good idea in a creative sector. So it's wonderful to have these three folks kind of working together on what's relevant, what we can do beautifully, where are we going to source cool ingredients, and what we think our fans are going to enjoy, and what are we going to enjoy as a staff. So the internal excitement builds, and then we get to see the outside reaction to it. It's cool.
Nowadays, Highland Brewing is located in a sprawling warehouse. When they moved in, it had been sitting empty, a waste product of shifting industries. In previous decades, it had been a ball bearing plant and then a velour plant and then a movie production studio. When the Highland team moved in, they found scarily realistic fake dynamite and rotating saw blade props. But given new life, it now houses not only their beer operations, but also a tap room and event space and a large lawn, plus 40 acres that they are building trails into.
And I can't wait for that to happen because I love to, I want to get outside and enjoy the beauty of the stream on the property and the trees and go around and then come back and enjoy a beer.
And this is the kind of area revitalization and sense of community that slowly eased people's reservations about breweries. Ann Fitton explained it this way.
What we're seeing again and again is, dilapidated old buildings in kind of downtowns that don't necessarily get a lot of foot traffic, but people are coming in and they're like, oh, I'm not going to rip this down and build a condo complex. I'm going to put a brewery here. I'm going to put a restaurant here. I'm going to make this a community center from the downtown. And it increases foot traffic. People have realized more and more that craft breweries are family friendly. There are communities, they get a little nervous initially because they're like, oh, they're gonna be drunk people lying in the street or they're gonna be beer cans everywhere. But when they see that doesn't happen and that these breweries are very open to community events, to group meetings, there are a couple local breweries that will, do what we're doing right now. It's not open hours, but you want to have a community meeting in their space, you just call them up and they'll open the doors for you.
Come have a nacho summit.
Yeah. And have a nacho summit.
2005 was another game-changing year for the Asheville beer industry when North Carolina House Bill 392, aka Pop the Cap, passed, pushing the alcohol limit from 6% to 15%. As you can imagine, this was huge for brewers.
Oh, yeah.
And for beer in the region. Highland was the first brewery to release a legal high-gravity beer. Before then, several beers had been advertised as 5.999 infinity 9% and were probably a bit higher than that.
And that brings us to more or less today. The community and the tourists have embraced the beer scene. And We don't mean to sound advertorial about it, like this is a statement of fact, but all the muss and fuss about Asheville's beer scene has caught the eye of some heavy hitters in the beer industry.
Sierra Nevada and New Belgium have outposts there now. Both announced these outposts in 2012 along with Oscar Blues, so that was another big year for beer in Asheville. On top of that, in mid-2017, Anheuser-Busch acquired local brewery Wicked Weed.
And this was controversial. And we'll get into that after one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's booted?
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now, it is a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so Wicked Weed. As of early 2017, it was one of the area's big success stories. It was founded in Western North Carolina in 2012, the brainchild of locals Walt and Luke Dickinson, with support of their local friends, the Guthy family. And it grew really quickly, from traditional American beers like Pilsners and IPAs to a rapidly expanding Funk and Sour program. Now, Funks and Sours, you've probably seen descriptors like that on beers in stores or tap rooms attached to styles like Gozes or Flemish Reds or Berliner Weisses. These styles are actually older than stuff like Pilsners, and they are made with strains of yeast and bacteria that create these funky and tart flavors. A quick beer science primer. You start with wort, a non-alcoholic grain and whatever soup, and then introduce yeasts, which eat sugars in the wort and poop alcohol and flavor.
Yeast poop.
Yeast poop.
Bacteria can similarly add flavor. After research around the turn of the 20th century let brewers start to control what yeasts and bacteria get into their beers, sours and funks fell out of fashion. The microorganisms responsible for them are really wily. So if you have one batch of sour beer in your brewery, you risk infecting your cleaner-tasting beers. But these styles have made a huge comeback in the past few years, and Wicked Weeds have been tremendously popular. Since 2014, they've had two outposts in downtown Asheville.
The Brew Pub, the scene of our lesson on flights, and the Funkatorium, which was possibly the East Coast first sour-devoted pub.
As of 2016, they opened a whole separate brewing facility, their fourth brewery in the area, just for funks and sours, called the Funk House.
For one of our first stops on our trip, we got the chance to tour Wicked Weed's Funk House with their warehouse manager, Jason Allison, and lead blender, Jennifer Currier.
How did you guys get into sours to begin with?
Luke wouldn't let it in the building. So it was pretty funny back in the day. And then it got kept in the little Funk House in the white building downstairs. And then from there, it expanded past an open fermenter and one tank to, I think we probably had like six tanks in there at one time. And it was crazy and packed. And we'd roll our little bottling line out from the corner every Friday and bottle. And then we'd put it back because we're out of room. And we'd move everything back into the space. But by then, we were only bottling like 15 barrels at a time. And now we package anywhere from 60 to 120 to 180 barrels at a time.
Oh, wow.
Big difference.
Yeah.
Part of the reason behind that increase in production is thanks to Wicked Weed's new owners. When AB acquired Wicked Weed, the original staff continued to operate pretty much independently. But in a town where local is everything, where people remember when that last Subway restaurant shut down, the idea of a big company coming in and taking ownership of something, well, it didn't necessarily go down well.
Nope.
Ann Fitton has a theory for the emotional response of AB's buyout of Wicked Weed.
So you can lobby and have and keep laws in place that support your business, but that often hurt smaller businesses. And so a lot of times the emotional reaction, particularly from other craft breweries, is that, you know, they feel like they've been bullied in some ways by Anheuser-Busch. They feel like they've lost shelf space. So that's really kind of where the emotional fallout is. And it doesn't mean that Wicked Weed or any other brewery that is owned by Anheuser-Busch isn't making great beer. I mean, Anheuser-Busch makes great beer. Making consistent beer in mass quantities over time takes a lot of skill. But it's more of the kind of David versus Goliath conflict of big money, big lobbying dollars versus small business.
One thing I found interesting, Anheuser-Busch was one of the first national beers available in Asheville way back in the 1800s, along with Schlitz.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right, but all of that being said, and you do have to say it, like the sale made national news. Beer folks here in Atlanta were talking about it like it was the day the music died. What we saw when we went to Wicked Weed was deep enthusiasm about the same things that everyone in Asheville is concerned about, you know, good local beer, from people who've been with the company through the sale for years. There's a Willy Wonka-esque sense about the place. Like, they've got money to buy spirit barrels, bourbon barrels, wine barrels, what have you, to age their beers in just twice or even once. But they've also got a wood shop on site where they turn those spent barrels into promotional displays and tap handles.
Wicked Weed is working on a lot of cool stuff, experimenting with different fruits, with those different barrels for aging.
Including footers, which are oversized barrels. Like in their case, they hold up to 220 hectoliters. That's about 5,800 gallons, and started life as Cavassier cognac blending tanks in the 1920s.
They're also experimenting with wild yeast and bacteria, spontaneous sours. They're using those malts from Riverbend Malt House, which produces their stuff right down the street from locally farmed grains. The hops and fruit aren't always local, but they're doing what they can to let the region shine through in each beer. Western North Carolina in a bottle. Or a can. Or a glass. But allowing nature to do its thing while you wait can be maybe not stressful, but A little bit stressful.
A little bit.
Anytime we're transferring something or moving it around, we're going to be rousing Brett, which is, again, our house primary strain. And I always go full Jeff Goldblum. Like, Brett finds a way.
The Brett in question here is a Brettanomyces, which is a genus of funky sour yeast known for being particularly pernicious.
Jen has an attitude towards beer making that reminds me of a scientist excited to see the outcome of a project. She even called some of the beer she was working on in the warehouse a house pet.
They showed us their cool ship room, and a cool ship is a traditional Belgian open-air inoculation tank. So it's this huge shallow tub, and theirs is in a room that's like a screened porch with wooden vents open to the fields and the wood outside. And so you pump your hot wort into this tub, and wild yeast and bacteria flow in on the breeze and spontaneously start the fermentation process. What you get is completely up to nature.
So as it's cooling and just hanging out in here, there's air just ripping through these louvers, and we'll leave this door cracked to encourage it to just come through a little bit more. Uh-huh. So all the wild yeast and bacteria that's just in the air that night will end up inoculating and fermenting this beer over the next 1 to 3 years. You have to be an optimist to do this, but it'll be super fun to see how that tastes. But again, we're trying to, as best we can, capture the flavor of this area. In order to do that, obviously we're starting with that Riverbend malt, but we've also planted an apple orchard out here on the property, and we have blueberry bushes, and we're going to be planting some blackberry bushes.
And okay, just to be clear, they're talking about creating a microbiome. They're planting stuff to attract certain strains of yeast and bacteria that will flavor their beers.
So not really looking to utilize that fruit. I mean, we will, but I don't think we're going to have enough to really do maybe at the Fungatorium with some pilot batches. Definitely looking to do some estate cider out here, which will be really, really cool. But really, we're just trying to encourage all of that microflora to come and hang out here.
Sure.
We want as many bees around here as possible.
They also gave us a taste of a house favorite brew called White Angel, which uses muscadine grapes from eastern North Carolina, which, if you've never had, are this very southern, or I associate it as being very southern thing, that's kind of earthy. And they source enough of them from a single growing season to use in this beer during fermentation, with some left over to freeze and use for balancing the flavor after barrel aging.
Yeah, it's just, for me, that one really captures, again, North Carolina, our house culture, and then a specific time and a place in North Carolina as a whole, which is pretty awesome. I always forget about how cool that beer is. It's so good.
Of course, Wicked Weed and Highland Brewing are not the only two places doing awesome beer stuff around town. They're just two that we happened to connect with. And thank you to both of them for showing us what they do.
With all of this craft beer focused in such a small area and more opening with relative frequency, we had to wonder, is a beer saturation point possible in Asheville? Turns out we're not the only ones pondering that question. Surprise, surprise. An article by that very name appeared in the local paper Citizen Times in 2017. It reported that North Carolina beer consumption had dropped in recent years, 25.3 gallons per adult in 2016, as opposed to 27.6 gallons per adult in 2010. On top of that, consumers are less likely to report brand loyalty. One beer brewer described the attitude as promiscuous. And the head of Asheville Brewing, Mike Rangel, said of the Asheville beer consumer, quote, "The beer IQ of the average Asheville beer drinker is probably three times that of someone in another city. Beer is sort of in our fabric. It's a double-edged sword. People have high expectations and support local breweries, but you better be pretty damn good." Damn good and also authentic, according to food critic Mackenzie Lunsford.
I'm not going to say whether it's breweries or hotels or whatever coming in that are trying to replicate authenticity, and that doesn't work. That doesn't work. And so it comes across as sort of a caricature of Asheville, and I think we're all a little bit worried that we're going to become beer Disneyland.
Oh.
Yeah. Malt Disney World. I said it.
Malt Disney World. It's an anxiety among Asheville-ians we heard more than once.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was even a feeling that we had ourselves when we beheld the campus that Sierra Nevada has set up there. I mean, it was lovely, and it had these huge awnings that were actually solar panels in the parking lot, and everything that we had there, the food and the beer, was excellent. But it was also real larger than life and expensive looking and just very stylized in a way that reminded me of a Disney theme park.
When we were over at Looking Glass Creamery talking cheese with Jim Perkins, she echoed this concern.
I think the explosion of the beer scene in Asheville is in some way, it's definitely a blessing, but it's also a curse. I mean, it's brought a ton of people here. It's a great place to live, so I understand that. And it means more customers for us, but it also means that this, you know, world, little world of Asheville is changing. It's a lot more traffic. It's a lot more people. Housing is an issue. And it also makes it hard to farm because it makes land very expensive. So that thing that brought people here, this local food connection, beer scene and whatnot, some of that may go away because they can't afford to be here anymore.
Another problem that is faced by the beer industry, both in Asheville and in general, is a lack of diversity. It's very white and male dominated. In terms of the sex divide, Ann Fitton pointed to historical issues of patriarchy in the workforce and the physicality of the work.
This is changing, but slowly. In her book, Ann Fitton has a joke that any gossip in the craft beer community is all he said, he said.
Oh.
Yeah.
And in terms of the race divide, that's a particularly sticky topic in Asheville, which is a southern city that, as of 2017, was 82% white.
You know, I was researching this recently, and there are actually fewer people of color here than there were 20 years ago. And I'm not sure why, but it does seem like there is more of a divide in some of these smaller southern towns. I mean, Atlanta is so sophisticated and multiracial and has been for such a long time, but that has not necessarily rippled out to the rest of the South or possibly even the rest of the country, particularly in rural areas. And, you know, it goes back historically to more than a century ago, you know, after the Civil War, when there was a huge diaspora of African Americans from rural communities into big cities. And I hope that that will reverse in a town like this. I know that the beer community, we have talked about trying to create more of a diverse community, trying to be very aware of that. But if you look at nationally beer as a whole, it's pretty dang white. So I don't know what the answer is, but it is something I would love to find more answers to.
Us too. And I know that some of those answers have to do with much more complex parts of American culture. You know, making Asheville businesses more inclusive is tied up in the politics of North Carolina at large, which hasn't really been a beacon of progressive hope recently. But, and this is going to sound sillier than it is at first, I hope that beer can help make it better.
Beer is more than just beer in Asheville. And we're not referring to the sprawl of businesses around the beer brewed there, like beer shampoo or specialized koozies. Breweries are neighborhood hangouts, a sports team, a place to hold a town hall to raise money or awareness about issues, or to host a nacho summit. The brewers are probably friends of yours. They bring people together like a sort of social glue. In the words of Leah Wong Ashburn,
there is power in beer because it collects people and people are happy about it. And they love to contribute to things. So while you're doing a beer, if you can do another great thing, then it just elevates everything.
This brings us to the end of our episode on Asheville beer.
Yes, though you will be hearing more about the beer of Asheville in our other Asheville-related episodes, for sure.
Yes, and if you're interested in learning more about sour beer, we have an old school food stuff episode on it.
Yeah.
All about the science and history, so check that out. And if you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is hello@savorpodcast.com.
You can also find us on social media.
What?
On Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, we are @SavorPod. thank you to all of our guests today and to Landis Taylor and the whole team over at exploreasheville.com for helping us find those guests. And also to our co-executive producer, Christopher Hasiotis, for helping us find those guest finders. Thanks, as always, to super producer Dylan for making our jobs easy, and to our other co-executive producer here at Stuff Media, Julie Douglas, for all of her good advice. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way. Nacho Summit. Yes, we had never known before that such a thing, such a glorious thing could exist, but the brewery wasn't open yet for the day, and at one of the, we were sitting outside, and one of the tables behind us had this group of chefs. They were having a nacho summit.
It sounds so official.
It does, but there were 10 to 12 people over there talking about nachos.
There were.
Which is very official.
It's beautiful.
They were there when we got there, and they were doing it for about the first 45 minutes that we were there. Like, it was a lengthy and in-depth nacho summit.
I can only imagine they were talking about, like, weight distribution and, like, liquid, how much liquid you can have before they start to get soggy, how to keep them crisp. Oh, beautiful.
But there were fruits from the summit.
Yes, there were horrifying and delicious fruits.
We were so full before and that morning. And it's 9:30 and there are nachos and you're on one side of the patio and the kitchen's on the other side of the patio. So you have a runway to watch the person bringing you the nachos. He's smiling. He's excited about what they've come up with. And in my head, he was nodding yes, and I was shaking my head no as he got closer in fear. It was a little bit like the shark coming up to your boat.
And nachos.
Exactly.
Nachos.
And they get there, and he explains the nachos to us in the middle of the interview, and they sound delicious. They look fantastic.
They have barbecue sauce on them. Cowboy nachos. So, yeah, they had, like, pulled pork and barbecue and some kind of crema.
And this is, mind you, the beginning of the summit. They were experimenting with something. They were excited to share. I saw them from the door, like, pointing at our table, like, happily smiling. And in the back of my head, I was like, oh, please, no. Please, no. Because I wanted to eat them. They looked so good, and I knew they would be good. But we were so full.
We all tried one, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.